You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And before we begin the program this evening, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Indigenous peoples today. I'd also like to take a moment to honor former Mayor Richard Reardon, who passed away yesterday at 92. We are gathered here tonight at the Richard J. Reardon Central Library, which in 2001 was named after him, which was a point of pride for him. He was a light in the city, an avid reader, and a champion of Los Angeles Public Library. Reardon and his wife Elizabeth, along with the Reardon Foundation, supported many projects at the library focused on youth and education. He was always incredibly enthusiastic about the work of the library and of the Library Foundation, and he will be sorely missed. It's a full house tonight. That's so nice. We're all excited about this program. So now we are in our spring programming, deep in our spring programming. So please check out our terrific programs at Aloud at lfla.org/aloud for more that's going on in the next couple of weeks. We have like a program pretty much a week going now. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private, nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in the support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to many of the Library Foundation members who are here with us this evening. Thank you. If you are not yet a member, I hope that you will consider joining the LFLA to continue to see more programs like this one and to support critical library services and initiatives for children, teens, and adults all over Los Angeles, helping them to improve their lives and to achieve their dreams. Now, for tonight's program, we are lucky enough to have the wonderful best-selling author, Cheryl Strayed, and the talented creator, showrunner, producer, Liz Tiegler, here to discuss their collaboration on Tiny Beautiful Things, based on a Dear Sugar column that first appeared in The Rumpus in 2010. Dear Sugar was an internet advice columnist whose identity remained anonymous until Strayed revealed herself in 2012. The column continues as a Substack to this day. Sugar quickly attracted a devoted following who quoted such aphorisms as, quote, write like a motherfucker, end of quote, and my favorite, be brave enough to break your own heart. Guernica magazine said of Dear Sugar, Sugar's columns are easily the most beautiful things I've read all year. They should be taught in schools and put on little slips of paper and dropped from airplanes for all to read. Here is the trailer for Tiny Beautiful Things.
How are you both?
Great.
Fine. Danny blasted porn on the Bluetooth speakers this morning.
Claire's vibrator literally melted from overuse.
Would you believe me now?
My life is a mess. My husband kicked me out a few days ago. My daughter hates me.
Oh my God.
Mom!
A threesome is a big leap. Maybe you were subconsciously worried about our little threesome. About
what?
Me and you and Dad.
Ew!
No, I don't mean it in that same way. How did I get so far from the person I wanted to be?
What would I tell my 22-year-old self?
Stop worrying whether you're fat. Who gives a shit?
And stop obsessing about your nose. Your nose is perfect.
Don't take your mom for granted. She won't be here forever.
Blair Marie Pierce
is an award-winning essay writer and soon-to-be college graduate with a 4.0. Come on out, Claire!
You're one of the best writers I know. An advice column is easy clicks.
Okay, take a look.
You should be the one doing this.
I'm not giving anybody advice.
What would I tell my 22-year-old self?
Someday, you'll look back on that one Christmas when your mother gave you a mustard yellow coat. Don't hold it up and say it's too puffy, because your mother will be dead by spring. And that coat will be the last gift she ever gave you.
I wish you weren't my mom. I could die tomorrow. And if I did, you would never forgive yourself, because that would be the last thing that you would ever said to me.
You're not the only one that could die tomorrow. So can I.
That is an awful thing to say to me.
I want so much for you, but you're not gonna get any of it if you don't want it for yourself.
What does it mean to heal? To move on? To let go?
Why can't you make new friends? Like, what happened to Bethany?
Bethany had anal sex on a Greyhound going to Reno.
What?
Yeah.
Why would she want to take a bus to Reno?
Cheryl Strait is the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. We have some fans, which has sold more than 4 million copies worldwide and was made into an Oscar-nominated major motion picture. Tiny Beautiful Things was adapted as a play and has been staged in theaters across the country and is a Hulu series. Cheryl is also the author of Brave Enough, which brings together more than 100 of her inspiring quotes, and the debut novel Torch. She has hosted two hit podcasts, Sugar Calling and Dear Sugars. Liz Tiglar is a creator, showrunner, and executive producer of the Hulu series Tiny Beautiful Things. She's also the executive producer of the upcoming Hulu series Under the Bridge. Most recently, she was the creator, showrunner, and executive producer of the limited series Little Fires Everywhere, based on the best-selling novel of Celeste Ng. The series received 5 Emmy nominations, including Outstanding Limited Series, as well as 5 NAACP Image Award nominations, a GLAAD Media Award nomination for an Outstanding Limited Series, and a WGA Award nomination for Adapted Long Form Series. Please welcome Cheryl Strayed and Liz Tiegler.
I think we're done.
We are done.
All right. Okay. Can everybody hear? All right.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Cheryl Strayed.
Liz Tiglar.
I'm going to start. Yes, we're so excited to be here. It's super fun. And we're just going to see where this conversation takes us. Who knows? But maybe we'll start with just talking about how this book came to be an adaptation. And how that happened, and why.
And why. You know, first of all, it's kind of, I always say Tiny Beautiful Things is like the book I wrote by accident. You know, it really genuinely is. When I, are you all, how many of you don't know, like, how Dear Sugar began, or the origin story? Okay, so some of you don't. I was just sitting in my house in Portland, Oregon, feeling rather good about myself because I'd finished the first draft of Wild, my memoir, and had sent it to my editor. And there's this lovely moment in a writer's life that you have finished the first draft and you know you're going to get notes back. You know you're going to have to do a lot of revisions. But you get to be a little bit delusional for a few days. And you think, like, maybe I am the first writer in history who has written the perfect, brilliant first draft. And so that was my state of mind when I got an email from my friend Steve Almond, who at the time, he was just an acquaintance of mine. He's this wonderful writer. Do any of you know Steve Almond? His work is phenomenal. And he's this wonderful writer who we had met at a conference and we had read each other's work and admired each other's work. And I get this email and it says, Cheryl, I write the Dear Sugar column at the Rumpus, and I know that you read it because you wrote me a fan letter through the anonymous portal, and you're the only person who's ever written me a fan letter. And when I read your letter, because I had said to him, listen, Dear Sugar, I don't know who you are, but I think you're a really good writer. I wish you wrote the column more often, because he would just write it intermittently. And he said, when I got your letter, I realized you're Sugar. And the reason I don't write this column is it's not like nobody reads it and nobody writes to me for advice and it doesn't pay anything. Would you like to take it over? Which is just like, basically it was like the description of my job up till that point, you know, no attention, no pay, you know, no hope. And I said, yes, I would love to, because my secret dream of life is to know everybody's secrets and to know like what's happening on the inside. That's what I've always been the most interested in. It's not who are we, but who are we really? Is anyone in the room somebody who took a writing workshop with me? Michelle, oh hi everyone. Okay, so you know I say that when I teach, it's like the business of writing isn't about telling the story of who we are, it's who we are really, who we are, you know, beneath the surface of the facade we present. And so as Dear Sugar, getting to have letters from people who were saying, this is my struggle, this is my sorrow, this is my bewilderment, I was given access to really genuinely what I had been exploring for years at that point, for decades at that point, as a writer. And so I started writing the column, and I thought it was going to be a lark. I thought it was going to be fun and snarky, and it ended up being sincere and some of the most meaningful work of my career. It continues to be. And meanwhile, so I'm, you know, growing this following online as Dear Sugar. Nobody knows it's me. And meanwhile, Wild is, you know, I'm writing the revisions, and it's nearing publication, and more of my writer friends are starting to guess it's me, because of course I tell stories about myself, true stories about myself in the column. And so I would get emails, and they'd say, hey, are you this Sugar person? Sam Dunn, did you do that? Yeah. You like messaged me on Twitter or emailed me? Yeah. And what did I say? Yeah. So I cannot tell a lie. So I would always say yes. And here's the other thing. You hear about how terrible the internet is, and it is terrible in some ways. And yet Sugar was completely born on the internet. The way people found their way to the column is people would tweet and say, you have to read this. And then that thing that happened with Sam, maybe 100 or so of my writer community friends would say, are you Sugar? And I'd say, yes, but don't tell anybody. And nobody did. You know, people really, they might have whispered it to other people, but nobody was like on Twitter, hey, I know who Sugar is, you know? And that was really cool. And so anyway, what happened is I said to my publisher of Wild, I said, there's this other thing I'm doing on the internet. And they were like, what is the internet? I mean, they literally, they wanted nothing to do with this. And I was like, will you just like publish this collection of these columns, you know, because editors were also emailing me, young editors who did know what the internet was, and saying, can I publish a collection? And so I was like, okay, let's do this collection. And so that's how it became the book I wrote by accident. And pretty quickly after that, you know, I had this experience, obviously making Wild with Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern and all the wonderful people who made that movie. And it was just so fun. And I got to see, I am answering your question about why is I got to see like how cool it was to have written a book and then have other artists bring their talent and their vision to it and then make something else of it and then reach a whole new audience. You know, I do think everyone should read books. But I understand not everyone does. Some people watch movies and TV shows. And so it was really cool to see the way that Wild reached people through film. And then now I'm getting this opportunity to see it through the show. So really the answer is I thought it would be fun and cool and interesting. What I didn't know is that I would have the opportunity to work with really genuinely such a brilliant, smart, compassionate, wise, talented woman as Liz Tiglar. So we became dear friends in the process, and that's like the greatest gift I got from this experience, really. But I want to ask you, my dear, the question you asked me. Why did you want to adapt this book to television?
Well, so I was given this book by my dear, dear friend who's in the audience, wherever she is, Mary Beth Basil. We made a show together years ago called Life Unexpected, and we know each other so well, and she handed me this book and said, you have to read this. This is like required reading. And that was my introduction to Tiny Beautiful Things. And so, like everybody, I underlined it. I wrote quotes from it and had it, you know, next to my bedside. And then years went by, and Cheryl's heard this story a million times, but basically I was in the Hulu parking garage doing the pitch out for Little Fires Everywhere, and Reese Witherspoon's producing partner, Lauren Neustetter, turned to me and she said, do you know who Cheryl Strait is? And I was like, yes, of course I know who Cheryl Strait is. Like, what are you talking about? And then I went on this whole rant about how she had written Wild and I couldn't wait for Wild to come out. And I had read the Mary Oliver quote at the beginning of Wild. And then when I married my wife, Allison, we used that as like the foundation for our wedding. And then we named our son Wilder. And I was like, yes, I know who Cheryl Strait.
She had to outdo me. It couldn't be Wild. Had to be Wilder.
I know. I was like, a lot of people are going to say they love Cheryl Strait, but where's my kid? Anyway.
Pretty much going forward, anyone who adapts any of my books has to name their child after me.
Yes, exactly. There's a torch out there. There's a Brave Enough out there. And so I said, yes, I know Cheryl Strait, not personally. And she said, would you be interested in potentially adapting Tiny Beautiful Things? And I, of course, said, yes, absolutely, yes. And mostly I was just so excited to get to meet Cheryl. So, of course, I, like, cruised back into the Little Fires writer's room, and I was like, oh, I mean, you know, I just might, like, have dinner with Cheryl Strait. And we met, and I was so happy to have not just, you know, like, screwed it up royally. And I was able to begin collaborating with Cheryl, and I think, the why did I say yes why did I want to do it was purely because of Cheryl. I did not know how to do it. I wasn't quite sure how an advice column would be adapted, but I knew I wanted to try. So that's how I came to it.
That's how it began. And then, you know, we did have, I mean, it was from the beginning, we just started to have conversations. And I know one of the biggest, I feel like that this was decided pretty early on from like one of the first conversations we had. And that is, you know, who would this sugar be? Just in rough form. Obviously, it took the writer's room, which I was in the writer's room and all of this. It took the whole long time to really develop the character. But we had to begin from somewhere. And Liz and I came to this idea pretty early on that our sugar, Claire, played by Catherine Hahn, who's just, I think, magnificent in the role, that it wouldn't be, like, her present-day story wouldn't be mine, but her past would be. That And I felt pretty passionately that because I do draw on so many stories from my life, especially those formative ones, things like having lost my mother young to cancer. She was 45 when she died. Having been estranged from a father who had been abusive to me and my siblings and my mother. Growing up poor and working class in a rural environment. And getting married and divorced young in my 20s. Those things are stories I return to again and again in my advice. And so I felt like, okay, she has to have shared this experience. And so what we began to craft in this character is somebody who in her previous life, like she's played by the young Claire is played by the magnificent Sarah Pidgeon. And so many of those scenes and the things she reenacts really are very autobiographical. And then we got to set ourselves loose in the beautiful freedom that fiction allows when we created, you know, what is our star doing? You know, what does her marriage look like? Thank goodness it doesn't look like mine. You know, what kind of arguments and conflicts does she have with, you know, at work and with her daughter and, you know, in all of these different environments? And we just got to make it up, which was really fun. How many of you have seen the show?
Oh,
my
wow.
Goodness. Awesome.
That's amazing.
Thank you for watching the show. You know, that. Thank you so much. I will say on behalf, I know a lot of you in the room are probably artists yourselves, but, you know, that is how we survive, is if you actually, you know, read our books and watch our shows. And so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I want to talk a little bit about you being in the writer's room. Would that be okay?
Yeah.
What'd you think of the writer's room? Was it what you expected?
It was, at first, it was not what I expected. I mean, it was so much more fun than I expected it to be. You know, I could never understand as somebody, so that all the it was my first TV writer's room, and all the TV writers, on day one, they informed me that I was what they referred to as a writer. And they were TV writers. And I was like, no, but you guys are writer-writers too. And they're like, no, we're not, actually. And it took me some time to understand what that meant. Because I couldn't, like, when I imagined the writer's room, I was like, so you're all there together. And I kept thinking that, like, together you literally, like, craft a sentence, you know? And I was like, this isn't going to work, you know? I've been doing it alone all these years. But what was really beautiful is we began with conversation and really storytelling. Yeah. You know, like we would be trying to come up with ideas otherwise known as pitches. Nobody has an idea in the writer's room that's a pitch.
Yeah, Cheryl had to like learn the language.
I learned the lingo.
The lingo.
But it was like, you know, Liz just would very beautifully guide us in the direction of the themes that we wanted to explore or the situations. And so, for example, we would, you know, in developing that relationship between Claire and her daughter, Frankie Ray, you know, everyone in the room had been a teenager.
Yeah.
And some of the people in the room had raised teenagers. And it was just like storytelling hour. Like, one time I had this fight with my mom, and she said this, and I said that. And the first couple weeks, I started to get a little worried, because I said to Liz, like, you know, when are we going to actually, like, write an episode? Because we're just, like, shooting the shit, you know? I was like, you know, one time I got a plum stuck in my vagina, you know? And we'd talk about
we're
that.
We're like, well, that's going in.
That's like, you know, and that's in the show. And then somebody else would go, yeah, you know, and I was, you know, and they'd tell, one, you know, I was left on a surfboard, passed out on a surfboard.
Yes.
And my parents found me. And that's in the show. And, you know, like, and I, and so Liz said, no, this is how TV gets written, is we sit around, we talk about things, and then slowly but surely, I think of it as almost like you're corralling like a herd of animals into a chute that eventually becomes an episode, yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's really fun.
And Cheryl fit right in, have to say.
I was afraid they would all like not like me because, you know, they would think that I was like, going to come in and be like, well, I'm the author of the book. But I didn't do that. I was the apprentice. I said that on day one. I'm an apprentice. You guys are the TV writers, and I just want to learn. And I learned so much, and I also managed to, like, be really part of it. It was really fun.
Absolutely. Now you're a TV writer. You're a writer and a TV writer.
That's right. How did you become a TV writer? Like what was your path to this job?
I went to Ithaca College and Ithaca. I didn't know that was in the movie Road Trip. And once I was like, Ithaca. And all these kids were like, Ithaca. And I'm like, wow, everyone's so enthusiastic about it. Anyway, this was a long time ago. But I went to Ithaca and they had a program where, like, instead of going abroad, you could go to LA. And I was like, perfect for me. And so I had come out here.
Is that true?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you could also go abroad, but I went to LA because, you know. And I came out here and I had done it while I was in college, but then I did it right when I graduated too. And when I graduated, the only show that was looking to hire interns, this was in 1998, was obviously Dawson's Creek. And I didn't really know anything about Dawson's Creek except this girl that I went to college with was like obsessed with the WB, and we were like, okay. But then I got out here and I was like, you're never gonna believe where I'm interning, Dawson's Creek. And so I started there, and it just happened to be at the era of, like, Greg Berlanti was a staff writer, Mike White was on staff, Ruben Fleischer was a PA. I mean, it was like a who's who of future Hollywood television and movies. And I started as an intern and worked as a post PA, but I would always hear the writers down on the other end of the hall, and they would do things that probably aren't really allowed now, but like when the season two writers started, all the season one writers took all these Scientology pamphlets and put them on the table, but then didn't say anything about it. And so all the season two writers got like really uncomfortable. Like, why is there all this Scientology stuff on the table? But nobody explained it until, like, finally after lunch, the season one writers were like, look, we're not trying to push an agenda, but if you want to work on Dawson's Creek season two, you're going to have to become Scientologists. And so I was down at the other end, and I was like, I want to do that. That seems fun. So I was like, I better learn how to write, and then I'm going to, like, get down there. And so so that was kind of my path. And I would sit in my office, and when outlines for Dawson's Creek would come, I would, like, write a scene off the outline, and then I would wait until the writers wrote the scene. And then I would compare their scene to my scene to see what they had done and what I had done. And of course I did all the obvious things. Every scene started with someone walking in a room, and every scene ended with someone leaving a room, and, you know, things like that. And I was just like, oh, people don't really do that in scenes. Like, you know, like, but I eventually, I wrote a really terrible episode of Dawson's Creek, and it was about a boat race, and it did not get me on staff. And so eventually I moved on and I went on to a show called American Dreams, and that was where I had another opportunity to write an episode, and I was a little more prepared and ready to kind of take advantage of the moment. And so that was my first time on staff, and it was a huge learning curve, and it's still one of my favorite shows to this day. And of course I thought, like, oh, once you get on staff, you're just like a TV writer. But eventually that got canceled, and then of course I couldn't get a job, and, you know, it's a whole cycle. But that was really how I became a writer, and then I just got to start to work my way up, you know.
And I know the answer to this question, so I'm not going to ask it, that, like, you learn something new with every project. I mean, that's true for me with the writing I do and other forms. And I'm just curious about, like, what did you learn from Tiny Beautiful Things, and what was challenging to you on this show, and what did you learn?
I mean, I learned, it's hard to probably capture what I feel like I learned from the show, but I would say, I think one of the biggest things I learned, and I'm just, like, speaking off the cuff because I haven't thought about it, is to trust my instincts. Like, there was a lot with this show that I think required a certain level of ambitious storytelling, especially for a half hour. And, you know, one of the biggest things, and we can talk more about this, like with every adaptation, you wanna adapt something in the spirit of the original work. And I think with Tiny Beautiful Things, it's a book that breaks the rules of advice columns, right? So I kind of wanted the show to have that rule-breaking feeling too. Meaning it didn't have to fit into a box of like, is it a comedy or a drama? Is it funny or is it sad? Is it, you know, all these things. It's like, it can be everything. And I think one of the biggest things that I was so excited about the show was this idea of blurring time and playing with time and using all the selves within us that could be present at any moment, meaning I'm 47, but I'm also 46, and I'm 43, and I'm 39, and I'm 21. I'm all of those things all the time. You don't become an age and all the other ages go away. And so I really wanted to capture this fluidity of different versions of Claire moving into each other's spaces, and that you could be fighting with your husband or having a hard time and suddenly you could see him as his younger self, or you could be your younger self, or you could move back into a memory from your past and reprocess it or metabolize it differently or heal something in yourself from remembering or just give yourself grace. And if I'm remembering right, not everybody kind of got it in the beginning. Am I remembering that right?
I know that you always had that vision and you had to fight for it a little bit because, well, not in the room.
No,
you
not
know,
in the room.
But the executives who ultimately have to say, you know, yes or no, which was really hard sometimes.
Yeah.
They were like, what is this surrealism stuff? You know, like they saw it, I think, as surreal. And in some ways it is, I guess, where, you know, those of you who have seen the show know what we're talking about. But if you haven't seen the show yet, so there will literally be times where, so Catherine Hahn plays the Claire, Sugar, but then Sarah Pidgeon, as I said, plays the younger, Claire. And there are times that Catherine will be doing something and suddenly what you see, it's Sarah Pidgeon. So she's like yelling at her daughter, for example, out of her younger self. Or there's this really moving moment when Sarah Pidgeon walks into the room, a hospital room, where she sees her mother in bed dying. And in a flash, she's the younger, what's the name of that? Marlo Buckley.
Yeah.
She plays the really young Claire, you know, the like 11 or 12 year old. And just Liz was really committed to this vision of telling that story of like the ways that we carry the younger selves. I was committed to the vision of trying to tell a truer story about grief than we often get to hear.
Yeah, talk about that and yeah, I'm so curious. Like I want to hear what were your fears about the adaptation potentially and like what felt vital to you?
Yeah, I mean, really early on, and I don't blame anyone for having this misperception because there is a kind of story of grief that's told to us that's a very kind of linear journey, right? That you have this, you lose somebody who's essential to you, and there's a time of great sorrow, and then it's in the past, and you let it go. And if you don't let it go, you're considered, it's as of like, oh, she needs to get over that, right? She needs to move on. And of course, what's true and what I know in my own life and in the lives of so many people, obviously so many people who've lost somebody who's essential to them, talk to me and share their stories with me because I've written about it so much. We say, like, it's not that we haven't moved on. I mean, obviously, I've gone on and had a life that's really happy and thriving and vibrant. But it's also true that I carry that grief with me even now, you know, that experience of losing someone who loved me the way my mother loved me, that experience of having to live my entire adult life without a mother, that is something that profoundly shaped me, profoundly informed me. And it's not some passive event. It's yes, it is something that happened in the past. It's also something, the only way that I've learned how to live with it is to carry it, Not leave it behind, but carry it. And not to carry it because it is a burden and it caused me to suffer, which is true, but also it's my life's greatest blessing. You know, that from that wound came really so much of the beauty that I have made in my writing. And what I know about so many of you who have lost somebody who is essential to you, from that loss came so, you know, came your bravest self, came your strongest self, came your deepest wisdom. And so I've always connected what the work I do as a writer, but specifically the work I do as Sugar, to my mother. There's even a column in Tiny Beautiful Things called The Obliterated Place, where I say, you know, this Sugar is the thing I built in my obliterated place. A grieving man writes to me and says, you know, he lost his son. How do I live? And, you know, what I said to him is, make something beautiful of the ugliest thing that has happened to you. And that's, you know, I think that's what artists do of all sorts. But so I wanted to, and that's certainly what I did to Sugar. So I wanted that to be Claire's story. You know, I didn't want her character, when you see those flashbacks or she's still grappling to some degree with some aspects of her loss, it's not that she hasn't been able to go on. You know, and you know, she struggles. She also writes this column that is so helpful to so many others. So, you know, she channels, you know, like all of that experience into a useful kind of wisdom. And so what was really beautiful is how much the writer's room really listened to that and received it and shared stories of their own losses. And, you know, Liz guided us in that. I think going in to the room, and I wonder if this is true for you, I didn't go into the room actually knowing that so much of my past life would be in the show. You know, those flashbacks, I was like, well, maybe they'll just be little things. But it didn't, as we went along, things expanded, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, it was so, I mean, first of all, it was so invaluable to have Cheryl in the room. But what would end up happening is that we would be talking about something and, you know, like in our second episode, for instance, you know, we were like, Cheryl, tell us about the day of your mom's funeral. Like, what did that day look like? And Cheryl proceeds to tell the story that she hasn't written about, which is that, well, you should tell it. I shouldn't tell your story.
I mean, that's the thing, the beautiful thing. I know some of you in the room are memoirists too. And the beautiful thing about writing about your life is you couldn't make this stuff up, you know, because it's so crazy. Like real life is actually like, people are like, no, that didn't really happen, right? And it did happen. So my mom was at this funeral home in Moose Lake, Minnesota, like a 20-mile, you know, a 20-mile drive from the house where we lived in the woods. And so I got my mom's, you know, outfit for her. They needed the outfit for her open casket memorial service. And so I get this outfit all together. We drive to town. I give the funeral director her clothes, and he says, where are her underwear? And I was like, well, I didn't think she needed to, you know, I didn't think she needed underwear. You know, and he's like, no, it's like a state law. And if she's not wearing underwear, and literally she's like gonna only be visible from the waist up. It's like one of those caskets where it's like, you know, one of those doors that has two, you know.
A two-door.
Which shouldn't be funny, but kind of is. Okay. So it's like, it's just like a little hatch, you know, that's going to open up. And there's my mom's like torso and head, you know. And they're like, no, she needs underwear. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, and there's an ice storm. I can't drive home to get underwear. He's like, if you don't get her underwear, it's not going to be an open casket memorial service. And blah, 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 you know. And so then we go to the drugstore. And so my mom died in March. So we're in this little town, and we go to the Ben Franklin drugstore. Were there ever Ben Franklins in LA? Do you guys know? Is anyone from the Midwest? Do you know what a Ben Franklin is? Yeah. So Ben Franklin, and they have they do happen to have underwear in the Ben Franklin store, but it's like novelty underwear. It's on the clearance rack, Valentine's Day like thongs. Which I don't know, like that's not even qualify as underwear. It's literally like, you know, and I'm like, okay, this is what we got to put mom in, you know, and on her dead body, you know, and it's so like weird and bizarre that like, and so I tell this story and Liz is like, that is definitely going in the show, you know. So stuff like that. And
I mean, even that story, I think, you know, because we're breaking the second episode at that point, so we're still figuring out the show. Like, the tone of that story so encapsulates the show. And that's what it meant to have Cheryl in the room. It was like we were constantly finding it and like pinpointing it and kind of bullseyeing it. And then she did the same thing two episodes later. We were like, we did this episode about faith, and it was a hard episode to break, and we broke it in all these different incarnations. It was a really hard episode to break. I feel like the room almost like dissented on that episode. Like, I was like, oh man, you can always feel like when the tide turns in the room and everyone disagrees with you, and it was like on Zoom. And so I was like, oh, I gotta, like, my screen's gotta go dark. I'm like super stressed out. And yeah, we had a Zoom room. But what made it so great is Cheryl could join, and not every writer had to be in LA. And we were trying to figure out again, like, do we do this in a church? Do we do whatever? And Cheryl just casually mentions this story where she's like, you know, my mom's like religion was horses, and we didn't have electricity. And so she used to take us out into this field at like summer solstice. We go in this field and lay down sleeping bags and sleep under the stars, and horses would come and just like two horses, but in the show it's like 10. We were like, all the horses, this is Hollywood, we need like a horse here and a horse here. And that was fun on set, a lot of horses, and then some CGI horses, but that would come and like sniff their hair, and like, I'm like, who doesn't want to be in a field surrounded by horses? This is like magical. And so of course then that starts to be like this language of the show. And so I can't even imagine how the room would have functioned had you not been in it. It was good that she was available and made time for us, because she started, and she was going to start with us and then kind of taper off, and then halfway through she was like, I think I've run out of time. And I was like, there is no time. You can.
You guys can hear me?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, your microphone is working, isn't it?
We'll share it.
Is mine not? Okay. I wanted to say about the horse. Well, one of the, like, we hoped that episode, we were really trying to figure out, like, you know, telling a story about the different things that people, that gives them faith. And one of the things I've said all my life, horses were my mother's religion. Sam, I know you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're probably crying, because I know that we share that. And it was really interesting because the room was like, well, okay, that sounds great, but like, what does that mean? And I was like, I don't know. I can't. It's so hard to explain. It was like the you know, my mother's experience with her relationship with horses all of her life was like the place where she felt free. It was the place that she felt, you know, at one with herself and the world. And that is what literature, like, books are my religion. Horses were my mother's religion. And then we have that, you know, and so what we were trying to do is to show, and then Claire, her character, her husband's mother, in one scene comes and then takes her hands and prays with her, because God is her religion. You know, she has that traditional religion. But what we were trying to do is tell a story about faith. And that's such, you know, it's such deep, hard work. I don't know how well we succeeded at it, but what was really fun and interesting was to get in there with a group of people and really try.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite episode?
You know, I go back and forth between, I have, like, I'll watch an episode and go, no, that's my favorite. But I have to say, like, I do really have a soft spot for the 107. And so that is the one, and this is where there are a couple people in the room, Michelle and Sam, and maybe some others. So I, you know, where there, it's this writer's retreat. And, you know, even though our fictional writer's retreat isn't at Esalen, you know, we tried to bring some of that vibe. And I just love that, you know, Claire, who's turned away from her writing, and but yet she longs to be a writer, you know, she goes and she wants to meet this famous writer who she reveres. And there's this scene that might be one of my favorite scenes in the whole thing, where she sees him, he's alone in the hot tub. It's her chance to talk to the great Hayes McEwen. who has written her a letter, you know, years before, saying she's a really good writer. Which is inspired by Alice Munro actually wrote me a letter, but for real. But in the letter, in the hot tub, we've learned that Hayes is like, oh no, my wife Murag would have clearly written to you because, you know, I'm a big, great literary man who would have never read your story or whatever.
She wrote the fan mail.
It's so fun, you know. I mean, it gives me such delight, and I think, as a writer, I feel it tells a writer's story, which really... What about you? What's your favorite episode?
Oh, I don't know. Every time I watch one, I'm like, I think it's that one. Yeah. And then I watch another one. I mean, the finale is... I love the finale. And I really love... Episode 5 is an entire flashback episode that was actually a little bit of an outlier structurally because it's an episode that really features young Claire. And what I love about that episode is that that's the only episode I would say that didn't stem from Tiny Beautiful Things, but came from an essay of Cheryl's called The Love of My Life.
Yeah, there is. I mean, that's like the secret little... That episode, they were like, okay, let's use that essay that's not in the book as the blueprint. And it was really fun for me to tell that, you know, to see that story told. So we want to answer we have some things here.
we have our sushi box.
This used to have sushi in it.
We ordered sushi.
But it was such a fancy box that Liz was like, I'm going to wash this thing out and we're going to use it as our magic sugar box.
Cheryl and I have been living together.
Yeah, when I come to LA to do stuff like this, I stay with Liz.
It's from Wabi on Rose, which used to be Wabi Sabi on Abbot Kinney, which burned down. Everybody was very not that enthusiastic about Wabi Sabi anymore, but I spent like basically all the aughts there. Anyway, it's back on Rose and better than ever, I have to say.
But look at the... So we
and
got
the
all these...
packaging is outstanding.
We ordered the sushi feast, and then we got all these boxes, some littler than this, too. Let me show you how they get opened.
I couldn't figure it out. And then look at
this. Ta-da!
And then the sushi was inside. Ooh, it's sort of still...
I'm suddenly craving a spicy roll.
but what we did today is we sat around and we just like to play parlor games. And so we just thought it would be fun to like write like random questions on pieces of paper and pick them out and ask them. So I'm going to ask.
Ooh, okay, here we go. This one's for you, Liz.
Okay.
And then you pick one and then I'll answer. Okay.
Okay.
Talk about how power comes into play in your work as a writer.
I feel like I had an answer for this and now I can't remember it, but I would say, I think it goes, well, I don't know. Here's what I'll say. I think you spend maybe, I have spent some time as a writer feeling pretty powerless because you, especially as a TV writer, you run this gauntlet of constant feedback and in order to do the thing that you want to do, you have a lot of obstacles you have to get through. Like notes from everybody. And so it's like, I dodge this. And you're like running this gauntlet. And sometimes I think it can leave you feeling maybe a little powerless. But I think it goes back to kind of what I was saying before about trusting your instincts. Like when you trust your instincts and you can listen to your gut and know something fundamentally, I don't know, it takes some guts, and that's kind of, I think, in some ways how I've stepped into it. I'm such a people pleaser that I can get very, do they like it, does everybody approve? And it's been interesting. I think maybe I've discovered this more in show running. This is kind of a roundabout answer, but when I'm on staff in a writer's room, I love to like get my ideas across and I'll pitch something way too many times, you know, and I know that you shouldn't and I really try not to, but like I get a real sense of like this would be great. When I am show running, I don't have to do that because everybody else is pitching and I am metabolizing and I'm hearing things, and it's a different kind of power, I think, that comes from sitting back and knowing you don't have to have all this output, but you get to kind of metabolize and feel something. And we were just talking about this the other day, like you can pitch something and it can not make sense to somebody, and just your reaction to how they feel about it can clarify what you want to do. And so for me, I think part of stepping into power as a writer is knowing it's not about what somebody else thinks, it's about how I feel about their reaction and what it tells me about what I care about. Does that make sense? So I'm like, I don't necessarily need them to like it, but I know how much I wanted to defend it shows something in me that, like, this is worth telling. Is that an okay?
One of the things I so admired about you is your leadership style was so kind and compassionate. Like, everyone in that room felt so affirmed and loved, and we had such a wonderful, really genuinely wonderful experience. And yet, there were also times that you had to say, like, this is what I want to do, or this is the direction we're going. And then I watched you, so we would write these scripts and we'd have to send them to some like castle where all the executives are. And then like all of them, you know, and they would range in age from like 20 to 82. Yeah. And they would give us notes. And I'd be like, who is that person? Like, why do they get to say what's in our show?
Yes, it was so great because it was also like, because we're looking at it through, Cheryl's not like in the television system. So she would say like, but why do they get to decide?
Yeah.
And I would be like, I mean, good question.
I know. There was something in the final hour, and I was like, yeah, I said exactly that. I was like, why does their opinion matter more than ours?
Yeah.
Because actually, we're the people who wrote the damn show.
Right.
But but anyway, that was really interesting to me to see also the way you were the master of making, like taking their note and, like, making the little change, but in a way that like kept, that maintained what you really wanted. Mm. And then there were a couple of times, there were a couple bruisers where it was like, you had to fight to keep what we wanted and you won. And then there was one that you had to fight and we lost. And that was interesting and hard for both of us.
Yeah. It's, so there's a moment, this isn't really like a spoiler, but there's a moment in the finale where young Claire and young Lucas are burying their mother's ashes, and this was drawn from Cheryl's life. Where
it's something I wrote about in Wild.
Yeah, and at the last minute, Claire kind of says, don't like pull this stone over this hole that they've dug. And she reaches in and she grabs some of the ashes and she eats them. And then her brother does the same. And we were on set and we shot it and it was so beautiful. And of course, they were also eating something like chia seeds. Like, you know, it was like not good. But it was so beautiful. And I almost regret having done this because at the last minute, I said to the director, we should do a take where they don't eat the ashes because I don't know what people are going to want. Like, I had gotten the note in script and I was like, we should just have a backup where they don't eat the ashes. And we like kind of got it. And then of course we got into doing the cut and it was in the cut and, you know, we did our cut, we gave it to producers and they were like, not sure about the ashes. And I was like, okay. I said, you know, it's real. It happened. And let's just, I hear you, but can we just see what the studio says? And then it got to the studio and they were like, the episode is so beautiful, but the ashes. And I was like, okay, I know. I already got the note, but like, can we just see what the network says? And then we got to the network and they were like, I mean, we can't with the ashes. And they were like, it seems like they're going down like a cannibal road. And I was like, I don't think it seems like that. And I don't think anyone's going to think, it's like, now it's Yellow Jackets. I'm like, I don't think so. And so, you know, I will fight really hard, but you know, I'm like, okay, if three separate entities who haven't discussed it are all having this reaction, I can imagine that an audience will have this reaction. So I made the decision to take it out. And I regret it. Like, I watch the finale, and every time I see it, and, you know, it works, and it's beautiful, but I'm like, there was just something there that was, like, only could have been Cheryl's, and I'm disappointed that it's not there.
Well, for what it's worth, I think it's still beautiful, but what's interesting to me about it is, so where, you know, where that began is in when I was writing Wild, I was writing about when my family and I spread my mother's ashes in this plot in northern Minnesota, and at the very final moment where I just had this tiny little bit left, I just found myself unable to let it go. And I put it to my mouth, and I swallowed those ashes. And all those years later, when I was writing Wild, I remember writing that line. I remember writing that about doing that. And it was as if, like, I had been electrically shocked by my laptop. And what I thought is, okay, I'm going to have to take that line out. Like, I can't do that. It's too much. That's what I thought. It's too much. I've gone too far. I've told too much, too true a thing. Even though I had actually done it, I was just like, I've gone too far. It's too much. And then, of course, whenever I think that, what I've learned over the years is, if I can just sit with it and let a line like that stay in, it becomes a sentence that lots of people talk to me about. I cannot even count the number of people who have come to me and said, I can't believe you wrote that. I thought I was the only one. I did that too. And, you know, it was like they, again, you know, it was a thing you're not supposed to say. But then when I wrote it, and then they came to me and said, I did it too, I did it too. And they felt seen by it, which I love that. That's what art does. It expands our idea of, like, what we're allowed to think and feel and be. But one of the most glorious things that happened is I also have an email, which I think somebody wrote to me, and in the subject line, I kid you not, it says, too much. And this woman is just like outraged. She's reading Wild. She goes, I was reading your book, and I was enjoying it very much. And then I get to this scene, and you eat the ashes. And I just threw the book across the room, and I'm not going to read the rest of it now because it's too much. You went too far. And I just laughed because I was like, you know, the thing is, that's what I thought too. You know, I don't disagree. And which, that is the glorious thing, right? Isn't it about creating things that you're like, yeah, I'm going to actually, like, imagine a world if all of the artists had said, you know what, I'm going to kind of stay on the other side of too much. I'm going to stay inside this line. You know, let's not push it. Let's not make people feel uncomfortable or feel like awakened or incited or recognized or whatever it is they feel. You know, and so I love that it was like she wasn't inaccurately reporting her response. It was true. And it was like, okay, it was too much for you and you didn't like it, but I would give money. I should email her now. It's been many years. I should be like, so now did you think about that moment? And did you figure out why it triggered you? Because it did. It told you something. It disturbed you. And I hope you examined why, you know, because it's interesting. And so all those people who thought I was like a cannibal, you know, in the castle of executives, you know, it's like, that's kind of interesting. They were like, stay inside the lines. But we tried not to as often as possible.
And look, if you look at Sarah Pigeon, you can tell she ate something. You might not have seen it, but you can tell.
We have never told this story publicly.
No,
you guys
are
the only ones who know.
You're the first.
It's true. We haven't.
All right. Okay. Tell us about a scene in the show that was the hardest to write.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, hard in different ways, right? I think that, I think honestly, and for those of you who haven't, oh God, can we talk about the very last scene? Maybe, does that kind of spoil, I don't know. Let's something else that was hard to write. You know, I know that there's the episode 6, we're really it's really an episode that's very much about the marriage between Claire and her husband Danny, who's played by Quentin Player. And you know, they're sort of in hard times. They've been together a long time. Love, you know, they had a lot of love. They have a lot of love, but you know, things have kind of gone, you know, awry between them. And they're trying to reignite their romantic and erotic life. And there were so many ways that we were, I think, trying to maintain like a sense of, you know, comedy, because there is so much about romantic and sexual relationships that we can laugh at. But we were also trying to say something like deep and true. And there is this scene between them. They go to this Mexican restaurant and they kind of have this conversation that's both about their intimacy, and they also have a conversation that's about their art, you know, the ways that Danny as a musician has let his career go, and the ways that maybe Claire hasn't followed through. And I just remember us really grappling with that a lot and going round and around and around.
Yes. I mean, that whole episode, it also required like a lot of conversations in the room. Oh, that's when we actually did have a scene with the plum up her vagina, and then they made us cut it, and then we put it somewhere else. They were like, too far. Remember?
All the things that actually happened to me.
Oh, they're all like, you know what? Oh, remember the scene that we had to cut? We had a scene, remember where...
we had to cut.
Oh, after she burned her thing with the thing. Yeah, after she burned her... with the vibrator, she goes to Amy and was like, can you look at it and tell me if it's okay? And they were like, nobody would do this. And we were like, it happened to somebody in the room. And we're like, oh my gosh.
It didn't happen to me.
This one wasn't Cheryl. But I was like, but so much of this episode, I mean, the porn on the Bluetooth happened to somebody in the room. The examining each other's vaginas happening to somebody in the room. Like, and then there was a lot of, it was a lot of like, them kind of mining what their own fantasies were. So that also required, I mean, there was a lot of discussion about fantasies and a lot of discussion about like what could happen with a vibrator.
Yeah.
And how.
It was a really hard nut to crack. And, So, but it was fun. I mean, but it was like, you think that would be just like the funnest episode to write. And it was actually the gnarliest, I think.
But then also it's like, you're not like anticipating thinking ahead to like when you're in the production, when all of a sudden you have like your schedule during prep of all the meetings and it's like 10 to 10:30 vibrator meeting. And you're like, oh, and then you have to go in and they're like, so which is it? So what was it? And you're like, well, I'm just saying like, someone might have had something like this happen. And you're like, oh. But anyway.
Yeah. So I feel like, too, we have to get to some audience questions. I know some of you wrote questions on these cards. So hold on. Well, like, I need another hand. I need my reading. The minute I turned 40, I needed reading glasses. Like, literally at my 40th birthday party. I suddenly couldn't read fine print. Okay, so here, wait a minute. Can you talk about the process of evolving the letter responses? I noticed the writing varies a bit from what's in the book compared to the show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say in terms of the letter responses from Claire, we really tried to fundamentally kind of honor those iconic phrases from the book. And really, any change to the letter responses was a result of just the episode and how things needed to add up, and also the condensing of the responses, because the responses are so beautiful and they're short stories in and of themselves. But you can't possibly, if you did that response in voiceover, it would have to start at the beginning of the episode and it would be a voiceover for the whole episode. So it was really...
Which I was totally fine with doing.
Yeah, I mean... Cheryl loved that idea.
We could just do a monologue of the letters.
Exactly. But no, it was hard. It was hard to cut down, and it was hard to, you know, as a purist, it was hard to change. But I really feel, you know, when I look at each episode and hear, you know, Catherine reading this voiceover as Claire quoting Sugar. the core of those responses remains very true.
Yeah, and Liz was really, I mean, that was sometimes hard for me because I crafted those sentences very carefully, and they did have to be condensed and distilled and sometimes changed to meet the needs of the show. And so Liz was always very open. If I would say, like, can I just revise that line? Cause it's like, and she's, you know, so it was this balance between also me just letting go. Like, there are a lot of the sentences from the book that are in the show, but then sometimes having to let it go and go, okay, that isn't exactly what I wrote. It got used in a slightly different way, and yeah, to be okay with it.
And sometimes letting it evolve. Like, there were times where we might need to tweak it for one note or another, but then at the last minute, we could change it back. So, you know, sometimes it's a little bit of like playing the long game, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, sadly, we're kind of, we have to kind of close out, I think. We've only got an hour and we've pretty much exceeded that now.
Okay.
But why don't we go with one more question?
Okay.
Which is kind of really, I think, a wonderful compliment to you, Liz. It isn't often that a show or film based on a book matches the emotional experience of the book. This did. And I just want to say, like, that was one of the reasons I knew you would be the most wonderful person to do this work, because you really cared about, you know, conveying that essence, the emotional experience. That meant a lot to me. Okay, and then now back to the card. It gutted me, like the book and all of Cheryl's writing did. Here's the question. It's in all caps. How did you do that? So that'll take like a year to explain, yeah.
I did it with Cheryl. That's how I did it. It's true. You know, Cheryl did it. And that was the beauty of the collaboration. I think I love to come to things and kind of beautiful-minded and piece things together, and I'm very into structure and storytelling and playing around with structure. And it was ambitious in a lot of ways, but I think there was just this core, and that core was Cheryl, and she was present, and her voice. I mean, the show, you know, I almost can step back and look at the show independent of my own role in it, because the show to me really is a love letter to mothers and to Cheryl's mom. And so when I think of the show, I think of it from the perspective of that. I think of it from the perspective of honoring Cheryl's story and her mom's story, and that's what makes it so beautiful to me. So it was both hard and easy, and I had the most important person beside me, and I think another most important person guiding the whole experience, right?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you all so much for being here with us tonight. I wish we had more time to answer this stack of questions, but we read them all. And thank you also for just the kind messages. Those of you who've read my books and watched our show, it's really, you know, we're so grateful. So thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.